Welcome everyone to our newest episode of Space Chai. Today we have an incredible guest with us, Mrs. Shelley Brunswick. So we thought we would, start off with a bang and get started with asking you some amazing questions. So can you please tell me a bit about yourself, like what you currently do and what roles you serve?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me to join you for Space Chai. And I've got my Space Chai right here. So we'll have a fun discussion and we'll keep it lively. For those of you in your audience who may not know who I am, I'm Shelley Brunswick, and I have over 35 years in the aerospace and space industry. And I look at it as four chapters. My first chapter was when I enlisted in the US Air Force right out of high school. I wanted to see the world. I didn't have college money, and I wanted to learn a profession. And so I joined the Air Force right out of high school. It was amazing. The second chapter of my journey is I went to school at night while I was at enlisted airmen, and I completed both my bachelor's and master's degree, and I applied and was accepted to become an officer in the Air Force. And that started my space journey, which has been 25 years. And then the third chapter is when I retired from the Air Force. I went to work at an organization called Space Foundation, which is the premier global organization that puts on the Space Symposium, which is an annual event that takes place every year in Colorado Springs. And now, as of this year, 2024, I started the fourth chapter of my journey where I launched my own company called SB Global LLC. And I'm excited to be a motivational speaker, author, and serve on various boards. So I'm excited to talk with you today and share what I might know with your audience.
Yeah, that sounds literally amazing. And having like such a long-spanning career like that, it's really incredible. And so I think because you've been in the industry for such a long time, I think one question that, I've had especially is like, how has your career in the space industry like changed your life for the better? And I guess what are some like difficulties you had along the way?
Absolutely. So that's a big question. So we'll kind of dissect it a little bit. So first of all, I'm going to share, I did not plan to go into the space industry. When I was looking at my future opportunities in the 80s, so that was a long time ago for many of your audience listeners, being in the space industry was not something that was commonplace, certainly for women. You also pretty much had to be in the military or maybe civil space with NASA, but primarily you were coming in the military. You might have been a fighter pilot. So it was a very different time. And looking at how the industry has changed over the last 40 years from the 80s to today, we really looked at, even think about the Apollo era. We think about the Apollo era, we're thinking of two countries in a space race. Primarily government workers. You're looking at STEM professionals, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And now let's fast forward 60 years to today, where we're looking at multiple countries are in the space industry. More than 90 countries are operating in space, and many more want to. You're also looking at a diversity of the career set. So we still need those STEM professionals, but we also need a myriad of other professions like policy and program managers, technicians, entrepreneurs, investors. We're also looking at, we still need government workers. We still need NASA and the US Space Force and others. But we also now have that commercialization side where you're seeing the commercial side really coming into launch vehicles, space stations, and then commercializing technology from space to apply here on Earth. So it's been a really exciting time to be in the space industry over the last 40 years to see this broad change. And I hope your audience listeners are thinking about finding ways to come into the space industry.
Yeah, I think like one thing that was so impactful just about, listening to your career journey and like reading the articles that you posted was the fact that like space genuinely can be for everyone and just that people really haven't had the opportunity to see themselves in the industry because of what you talked about with how the industry kind of evolved over time. Do you think that also might just be a function of the fact that it is like a new industry, or do you think like what are the other kind of gaps where you think that could lead it to contributing to people not necessarily being able to see themselves in the space industry?
So I think that's a really great question because a lot of times when people think about space, they only think about the vertical of space. Launch vehicles, astronauts, we're going to the moon and on to Mars, which are all exciting things. But they may not see how space intersects with other economic sectors like agriculture or the Internet of Things or finance, and what I want to highlight is that if you're passionate about these other areas, these emerging technology areas as well, where we're looking at energy and energy storage solutions, healthcare, miniaturization of technology, AI, VR, you know, we're seeing all the excitement about AI and quantum. There's an intersection between space as well as those emerging technologies or those other economic sectors that most people don't think about. So you could be passionate about agriculture and space, or healthcare and space, and find that intersection that helps you find your purpose in life.
Yeah, no, that's actually incredible.
Okay, so I had a question about like the intersectionality. So would you say that it's always existed within the space industry, or do you think that like it intersecting with other fields has become like a more recent trend?
I think it's become a more recent trend. What we saw when we invested money during the Apollo era, we saw that investment in that technology that has then been tech transfer to commercialization. So one of my favorite forms, you know, of space technology is in your iPhones or in your phones is space imaging technology. So for anyone who knows me, you know, I love a good selfie. And thanks to space technology, you're able to take those. So that's one technology we're using every day. We're also recording this interview on Zoom, and telecommunications was a function of the space industry. It was created for space travel. The other one I'm really excited about is fire retardant clothing. You know, that was developed for the Apollo era. And my husband, you may not know, was a firefighter for 30 years. So thanks to that fire retardant clothing and that space technology, he was able to come home every day. So initially, 60 years ago, technology was created just for space. And then as time went on, they realized they could take this technology and commercialize it for use here on Earth. And that's why we have telecommunications. I mean, think about what the pandemic, COVID, would have been like had we not had telecommunications, you know, telehealth, telework, teleschool. So it would have been a very different time frame for COVID and that pandemic. So again, space technology is so immersed in everything we're doing every day. On average, you're probably connecting with a satellite 47 times a day. You just don't know it. So for your audience, if you want to be in space, there's probably already an intersection, and it's much more commonplace than it was several decades ago.
I am curious to, would you mind if I ask a question? What inspired you originally to like join the Air Force? And from that point, what pushed you one step further into space?
Well, excellent. Well, one of the big things was I wasn't ready to go to school yet. So maybe that's not good for all your university students, but I wasn't ready to jump into going to school right after high school. I wanted to see the world as well. And joining the military back in the 80s was a great way to get stationed, because yes, you can travel the world. You didn't really do it in the 80s as much as you can today. But I really wanted to have that cultural immersion where the military, the Air Force, allowed me to get stationed in Turkey and Germany, you know, really get to meet people, try different things, understand different cultures. And we've seen how globalization has created so much more, where it's important to understand culture and connect with people and interconnectedness. So I have to say, you know, joining that military right out of high school, wasn't ready to go to school, didn't know what I wanted to do. That's the other thing. It's okay if you don't know what you want to do. You know, you're going to zig and zag and you'll find your place. And then it also gave me that opportunity to be stationed overseas. I learned a career skill. And I went to school at night using a thing called tuition assistance. So I was able to complete my degrees. And then that allowed me to become an officer. And then the Air Force made me a space program manager.
It's very interesting. Thanks for sharing.
You're welcome.
Yeah. And I really appreciated, you know, hearing about that, because I do think that, especially with more, I would say, technical or perceivably more technical fields, there's always this kind of expectation that everything has to align in a very like linear trajectory, where everything is planned and prepared and, you know, set forth for you. Like, you do this training and then you get this degree and then you get this job, and the ladder is very defined. And so, you know, one of the industries that you had kind of mentioned was that, you know, we also need entrepreneurship in space, and we need, you know, startups in space, just like how you started your own company. And so that kind of brought up the question of like, how do entrepreneurs and, you know, startups or people who want to get into the field, like, navigate the complexities and like the regulations associated with entering the space industry? And like, what advice would you give to people who want to venture into that sector?
Just do it. You know, if you want to be an entrepreneur, give it a try. And you're seeing great entrepreneurs nowadays in the space industry, whether it's Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos. But you have to remember, both of them had entrepreneurial missteps as well. So being an entrepreneur is probably the hardest you'll ever work for the toughest boss you'll ever have yourself. But the best time to try these things is while you're young. You're going to learn things, find mentors who can help you. But the biggest thing I would say is if you want to be an entrepreneur, what is the problem you want to solve? It's really about figuring out what is the problem or challenge you want to solve. What is your solution and why is it better than anyone else's? And what is that passion that drives you to bring that to market? And you can see that passion in so many entrepreneurs, that passion to solve big problems and create new solutions that are better than anyone else's. And so a great place to look, you know, for those of you who are thinking you want to be an entrepreneur, one of the best places you can look for ideation is to go to the NASA Tech Transfer website. NASA has thousands of patents that are waiting to be commercialized, just like the ones I talked to you about earlier, you know, formulated food, you know, athletic clothing, materials, all of that came from the space program. So there's thousands of patents that are waiting for people to apply for. You could even apply for a grant, a small business innovative research grant to try to start to build out that business case to commercialize that technology. And again, they're in all those different sectors, whether it's agriculture, communications, AI, robotics. So for your audience, there's a way for you to be an entrepreneur. And if you want to be in the space industry, you could start by going to the NASA Tech Transfer Office.
Okay, I had a question about like the commercialization of the space industry. Would you say that like an increase of like entrepreneurs like within like the space industry would lead to like more commercialization? And is that a good thing or a bad thing? Or how will this like translate into future years?
So your answer is a yes and a no. So I think commercialization plays a great role in the space industry because commercial companies operate very rapidly. You know, when you think about the time it takes to take something from ideation to implementing it in the marketplace, you want to make a return on your investment. So whether you're an entrepreneur or an investor, you're looking for when is that return on investment? Now, in the space industry, we do know that that return on investment can be longer. You know, it took a little bit longer for SpaceX from when the legislation was passed in 2004 to allow for commercial companies to do launch vehicles to where they had successful launches that met all the requirements. But in the bigger scheme of things, because SpaceX entered the commercial launch industry, it lowered the cost of launch exponentially, which allowed more opportunities for individuals, citizens, universities, and countries to now have access to space. So, yes, I think commercialization plays a great role in creating more access and opportunity. Now, the second side of that is that's where government comes in. Government's job is to create the regulations that oversee the commercialization side. And so you can watch a lot of TV. I won't cite any cases, but you can see where maybe the government should have legislated more. You're seeing a lot of areas. Space is one. I mean, there's a lot of great opportunities for space policy, space lawyers. You know, what are land use rights on the moon? What's the healthcare applications? What happens if somebody has a research center and somebody else is mining on the moon, but you know their facility loses power and they break into the other facility. What does that mean? So there's a lot of space law, space policy that has to be decided and developed, and that is the role of government also to create great legislation that creates the architecture that allows space companies as well as any companies to flourish.
I am curious. I know there's like maritime law. I'm assuming there's aero law also, like a national airspace. How has that influenced how you view space law and policy?
So space law and policy, as they call it, is the Wild West right now. There's a lot of opportunity. And the challenge is there's, you know, space is for all of us. And that means, you know, you have air rights above your country, but you don't have space rights. I mean, there's satellites orbiting all the time, there's space debris, there's all kinds of things. So to create policy, you can create some policies in your country alone. That allow business to flourish. You know, one country that has done a really great job of creating an ecosystem for businesses is Luxembourg. They've done a great job in creating space legislation, space policy to allow companies to flourish. But the other side of it is the treaties that are currently in place with how countries will operate together are fairly, they're like 50 years old. So there's a lot of opportunity to reevaluate what the treaties are. How do we come together? How do we create new policies? But the challenge right now is the world is somewhat polarized. So getting everyone to agree to a treaty is pretty remote right now. That's part of understanding policy and legislation and the role of governments, because right now there's not a lot of will to create new treaties for space. But what there could be are opportunities to agree to guidelines. And that's what NASA has taken an initiative with their Artemis Accords. They're going around asking countries to sign on to the Artemis Accords. It's not a treaty, but it's how we could operate in space together as we go on to the moon and eventually on to Mars. So policy and legislation is what are you capable of getting done right now? And right now, there's probably not a lot of room for new treaties, but there are probably a lot of opportunities for partnership, collaboration. And so for those individuals who are listening, we need policymakers, we need good diplomats, and we need good space lawyers right now.
Yeah, I really just kind of, really loved hearing about that too. And I think one question that the whole discussion with space law and policy brought up is, on one hand, the commercialized space sector is completely new, and we don't even know all the capabilities that it has to achieve. Like, for example, even with the internet, we didn't even see that coming. And so there tends to kind of be a backlog between when innovations occur and then how law adapts to that. But if we want to create like effective policy and law while simultaneously understanding that we can't even anticipate fully all the kinds of technologies and inventions that we're going to create, how would that dynamic effectively work? And how should, future policymakers try to even address that?
Well, I worked on Capitol Hill. That was part of one of the things I did when I was in the Air Force. I was a budget and appropriation liaison. And so it's really about being able to help educate congressional members and senators and their staff, as well as the committees, about what is space technology, what's coming, what could be good for business, but what also could be good for the common goodwill. And so in the US, one of the challenges we have is that a lot of the space policies are divided amongst different organizations, whether it's the Department of Commerce or the Department of Transportation with the FAA, or is it in the US Air Force or Space Force? So it's in DoD. So the challenge right now with the US and how it competes with other countries, because you got to remember, the US is one player in space, and although it has a great way of doing business in space, there are other countries, like I mentioned, Luxembourg, that have created a very different structure for how businesses can incorporate and do space business, even though Luxembourg does not have a launch facility like the United States does or other parts and pieces. They've made it very easy to do business in the space industry in Luxembourg. It's kind of like in the US, a lot of people want to incorporate in Delaware. So I think what we have to do is we have to help be good advocates. I mean, that's part of what I'm doing with my company, SB Global LLC, is how do we create education and information for those policymakers to understand how does space benefit humanity? How does space benefit the constituents here in the United States or constituents in other countries? How does it benefit their everyday lives and makes things better? And then how do we create the policies that create the opportunity for that industry to grow and flourish and create more opportunities? Opportunities for investors and entrepreneurs with good oversight from the government.
I was wondering earlier, you mentioned that all of these things, like, or any entrepreneur is looking to solve a problem. And I was just wondering, like, what is your space problem or issue that's like your mission, I guess?
Well, I think the biggest thing I like to highlight is a lot of times when people think about space, they think about what they're seeing in the news, Elon Musk, Artemis, we're going back to the moon to go on to Mars. And those are exciting things. And those are definitely things we should be doing, as well as exploring our solar system and beyond. But I think one of the things that many people and your audience may miss is that we are bringing that space technology back to Earth to solve our challenges here on Earth. Some people say, why are we doing space when there's so many problems here on Earth? And you're right. There are a lot of challenges. We can look at the Sustainable Development Goals that were agreed to in 2015 by all the members of the United Nations. And we're supposed to accomplish those Sustainable Development Goals by 2030. And we're very very far behind when we think about, no hunger, water security, gender equality, quality education, partnerships and more. So many people will focus in and say, well, there's so many challenges here. Why invest in space? And what I want to share with you is investing in space and that infrastructure and that technology is benefiting us here on Earth. If you go to the United Nations Office of Outer Space Affairs, and it's ANUSA, is it short, anusa.org, from their drop-down menu, they list all 17 of the Sustainable Development Goals and how space is part of each and every one of those solutions. So I want to make sure that people understand that space is part of the solutions to our greatest challenges here on Earth.
Yeah, that's a really great insight. I had a question going back to like the commercial space sector. What are some key like challenges companies face when they are wanting to enter the sector? Like lack of information, et cetera.
Well, I think there's a number of components. If they want to go into the space vertical, there's various economic sectors. So there's a space sector. It can be a high barrier to entry, right? If you want to create a launch vehicle, obviously you have to have the right people, you have to have the right technology, you have to have a lot of investment, or if you want to create the next space station or so on. So there can be a high barrier to entry, especially into that space vertical, but there could be a lot of easy ways to enter. And like I shared with you, that NASA has that tech transfer office. So if you're looking at how you can use space technology to come into another sector, one of the ones I love is, here we are with our phones again, right? And one of the great things we can talk about is look at the companies that have been created because of the infrastructure that space has created, like Airbnb, Uber, Lyft. All of these companies, although may not realize that they're benefiting from space technology, are living and riding on that infrastructure that is space. It's similar to when Jeff Bezos started, Amazon. It was about delivering books. Well, he did not have to create the post office to deliver books. So a lot of the great technology that space provides is an infrastructure that's already provided free of charge, usually due to the US government with GPS, to create that technology that has now created a whole new industry. We can also think about finance. The entire financial system is running on space and cybersecurity. Think about all the fintech products that are operating. If it weren't for space and cyber, those would not exist either.
Yeah, it's like really interesting to see like the intersectionality between like different sectors and to see how like you could use another sector in order to become a part of like the bigger picture of the space industry.
Absolutely.
One of the sectors that's been like on the news a lot lately, been a buzzword, is AI. How is that going to be relevant in the space industry?
Well, I think a lot of what we see today is we don't really know what all AI is going to do because we're just at that starting point. It's an exciting point. It is going to revolutionize not only the space sector, but every other sector out there in ways we don't know. It is going to be a disruptor and an enabler. For space right now, you can look at it in a few ways. Right now, there are so many satellites operating in space, and that download of information is greater than a human being can process. So you can use artificial intelligence in looking at the data that's coming off satellites, creating something that's actionable, and then providing that to the human in the loop, as they would say in the military, the human in the loop, who could then take action on that intelligence. So there's going to be a lot of ways that you're going to be able to use the data much more efficiently than you've been able to use before. You can use it for predictive analysis. We can look at weather forecasting. Think about how much faster AI can run those simulations or Monte Carlo scenarios. So AI is going to allow things to happen much faster than we've been able to do currently. But again, the sky is not the limit when we think about AI and the opportunities it's going to bring to allow us to figure out how to do things faster, more efficiently, take action on things, and find new areas to create new business solutions and profitability.
I really loved actually, hearing about like the whole AI discussion because I think artificial intelligence is also something that's like really being pushed heavily at USC. Like I know within our Marshall School of Business, they're bringing in like an AI and business major, or it's just something that we're, discussing more and more. But as we integrate, I think, more advanced forms of technology into every sector, including space, I did have a quick question about what the security concerns could look like with that, because even with cybersecurity over the past couple of years, we've seen kinds of different breaches and how that could impact, more expensive infrastructure like satellites in space.
Well, the challenge with the satellites in space, especially the legacy, I'll call them satellites, is they were built at a time where there wasn't concerns about harmful actors in space or cybersecurity or hacking of satellites. And now as we've progressed, we do realize that there are actors out there that are operating in space that could jam satellites, that could disrupt, provide false information, even tow satellites out of space, move them, or destroy them. So the world that we started in the 60s with Apollo to where we are today has become very competitive, congested. And we have to look at new ways of how do we harden those satellites we have that could be just military or defense. But another strategy they've done is distributed agriculture, a system architecture. And what they've done is maybe instead of creating these big, juicy targets in space that are just a big, juicy defense satellite for communications, maybe what they do is they create smaller satellites, partner with commercial companies, and put multiple communication apparatuses on commercial vehicles. That way, if one is taken out or one stops working, then there's redundancy in the system. So they're creating different architectures for how we could protect, especially the defense and national security of space for the United States, as well as other countries through that distributed architecture idea. So there's a number of things we can do. They can also look at hardening those satellites that go up. You know, how do you create opportunities where they're not as easy to manipulate. And then there's another whole new side that's really exciting, the commercialization side. You know, once you launch a satellite, that's it. The amount of fuel it has is all it has. But what they've learned is there's a lot of great companies that are looking at how they can refuel satellites while they're in orbit. So we can reuse those satellites as well. So I have an article coming out in Forbes later this month that will highlight Earth Day. And the thing I'm highlighting is how we're going to look at reusing those satellites and satellite servicing technology to continue to keep using those satellites. So again, you know, tying in with those sustainable development goals and how we can reduce, reuse, and keep using those same satellites.
Okay, so I have a question. Recently, I saw a quote that said in the post-Cold War society, space policy is international policy. How would you correlate that to like the commercialization of space, and what like role could like international relations play in that?
Well, I think the first place we can start with is that going to space, that vertical of business development is a very expensive undertaking. I mean, you can look at the United States moving forward with returning to the moon and going on to Mars, creating the cislunar economy, the Artemis program, returning astronauts to the surface of the moon. It's a very expensive endeavor. But what we can see is the US is not doing it alone. They're doing it with other countries and partners. You know, this first mission for Artemis crewed mission will be with a Canadian, so a neighbor to the north. But there are other astronauts, whether it's from the UAE and other countries, that are participating. So there's a high cost to space that can prevent companies from coming in. I mean, obviously, you're seeing where billionaires have an opportunity to create space verticals. But the other side of it is where I talked about the orbital debris challenge. Well, that orbital debris is operating in space, which means it's not necessarily controlled by a certain country, although each piece of orbital debris and each satellite is under the control of the government that launched it. So anytime a US entity launches something, they have approval from the US government. So technically, each piece of orbital debris that needs to be removed, cleaned, whatever, is flagged, you can say, just like a ship, by a country. So there are some challenges with orbital debris. How do we remove it? It doesn't necessarily, you know, the rights of salvage that we have here on Earth are not necessarily the same rights in space. So they're figuring those pieces out. So space is one of those areas we're very diplomatic. I mean, look at the International Space Station. We're partnering with other nations to include Russia on the International Space Station. We will continue to partner, and we'll continue to partner with other nations. So space law is a global issue, and then there's also national law. As we come to each country, then has to decide what is the space policies they want that allow commercial companies, or they want to invest in commercial companies. And that could be the part of public-private partnerships where the government says, I will help invest in commercial companies, and then that commercial company takes over on behalf of the government. So one example of that, again, prior to the legislation of 2004, which allowed for commercial companies to become launch providers, it was always the government that created a launch vehicle, whether it was the Air Force or NASA. Then after that 2004 legislation, which created the opportunity for commercial companies, that's where you saw the opportunities for all these new commercial launch providers. And now you're seeing where the government is just buying launch as a service versus the government is not competing anymore to create launch vehicles. They're just going to buy those launch vehicles from various providers. And you're going to see that also, you're starting to see that now public-private partnership as we look at the International Space Station. It's due to retire in 2030. And so you're seeing NASA award multiple contracts to commercial providers for a space station. And the U.S. government will just be a tenant of that space station. And there'll be opportunities for other companies to be tenants as well and do work on that space station. So that is the role of governments as well as the international community. And again, a great organization that does that international work for your audience is that United Nations Office of Outer Space Affairs. You can go to their website. In addition to space law and space policy, they do space and water, space and food, space and youth, space for women. So there's probably something that you might be interested in, and you could join that organization and contribute on a global level.
And then I had a follow-up question. So you said the International Space Station is set to retire in 2030, but you were also talking about space debris. How are they planning on retiring the International Space Station? And like, is there a potential of having more space debris come from that retirement?
So the current plan, and again, I'm not an expert or intertwined with the plan that they have, but their current plan is to deorbit the International Space Station and plunge it into the Pacific Ocean. So that's kind of what the current plan is. There are a number of organizations that are against that plan. Some organizations would prefer that, you know, the International Space Station is a historical landmark, and they'd rather see it supersunk into a deeper orbit, and so that it could be used for opportunities for others to explore, view versus deorbiting it. So I'm not going to get into the politics of either or, but that currently the plan is to deorbit it. There are those other organizations that would prefer that we supersink it into a deeper orbit so that it can be there for others to view and you know, look at it similar to how there might be a wreck on the bottom of the ocean. People want to go dive that site. They want to leave the space station as an opportunity to dive that site, we'll call it.
I was
That's
curious.
great.
Oh yeah, I've seen a lot of videos of the space debris like orbiting our Earth. How much of a problem is that becoming in like organizing launches of satellites? And is that like just inhibiting progress, I guess?
So it is a problem, and I did share. I'll be having a Forbes article come out that talks about orbital debris for this month for Earth Day. It is a big challenge. The more debris there is, the more times you have to look at launch windows and where that debris is. Because think about it, that debris is like a bullet. It's traveling, you know, fast, and then when it hits something else, that other thing is also like traveling at a bullet. So it's like two bullets hitting each other that explode in space, creating, guess what? More orbital debris. And a piece of orbital debris could take out the International Space Station. It could take out a launch vehicle. So it can take out a satellite. So it's very not good. We'll go with that word. It's not good. And what we need to do is we need to look at reducing the amount of orbital debris we're currently launching, you know, because what we've seen from the start of the space era, you know, we just used to let things fall off those launch vehicles, and that became orbital debris. So one, we need to stop creating more orbital debris. Second, we need to find ways to reduce the orbital debris we have. And there are some amazing companies out there that are looking at, again, how do we reuse satellites? How can we refuel them? How can we create, you know, little gas stations in the sky that refuel those satellites? How do we, there are companies out there that are looking at capturing obsolete satellites and orbital debris and capturing it. And then could it be reused in space? Could it be recycled in space to create new activities? We could do manufacturing in space of that orbital debris instead of, you know, having it re-enter the atmosphere. And then of course, orbital debris is passing over all of the Earth. It's not just one country's problem. It's every country's problem. So it's an opportunity where we can work together with other nations to create policies that can help us manage this orbital debris challenge.
Yeah, I think like the whole, you know, just kind of discussion about around space debris is a very interesting one, because I remember seeing even like a post about it and thinking in my head, if we don't get ahead of the space debris problem, and we've tried to deal with it with the same backlog that we have with sustainability here on Earth, I'm like, what if we just trapped ourselves in the planet? Like, then what would we do? There's no moon, there's no Mars, there's nothing. But I think that's also kind of why I remember you talking about how space education is important in your, you know, Forbes article. And so I kind of just wanted to shift gears a little bit. And, you know, like, this is all new information for us. So thinking about how space education can progress and become more effective, because like, I think all of the insights that we've even had in this interview today are something that most people wouldn't have even known of.
Well, I think space education is really important. And many times when people think about space, they're thinking about history, right? They're thinking about the Apollo era, or they're thinking about memorizing the planets. And is it 8 planets or 9 planets? Is Pluto a planet? So we're, a lot of times when people think about space education, that's what they're thinking about. But I think what we need to share and highlight is that space education is about helping young people find career paths and opportunities. And we need to start this as soon as possible. We need to create space education. We need to bring it into the day-to-day classroom so kids understand how space is part of our everyday lives. Like I said, it's there's multiple algorithms already in your phone. There's GPS, there's selfies. There's already technology that kids are using every day that's part of the space industry. And so we need to start it as young as possible, you know, elementary school, so that kids understand that space is not just about planets and history, which it is, but it's also about the future. It's about the future of humanity as we become an interplanetary species, as we harness technology and resources in space. And it's also about how space is going to help us solve the sustainable development goals and the challenges here on Earth. And so what we can do with young kids is we can bring that space into the day-to-day classroom, showing how space and science are fun and engaging and could become career paths for these kids to have. And that also then helps to break down barriers for underrepresented groups in the space industry. Because most times when we look at a picture of space, and if you look at an Apollo era picture, you're primarily seeing white male STEM professionals that were the space industry. So we need to really highlight the diversity of role models that exist today, and we need to help kids find their pathway, find a role model that looks like them, and a career path that could help them come into the space industry.
Okay, I have a question. So it might seem like a little like redundant, but like you talk about like us becoming an interplanetary species, but you also talk about this growing concern that people on Earth are having about like space debris, pollution, things going on in space that affect like here on Earth. I don't know how to ask it. Like, why is it necessary to like care about stuff on Earth when we're planning on becoming an interplanetary species?
Well, you can just look out at all the other planets in our solar system, and we're the only planet like this. Earth is a beautiful blue dot, right? The overview effect, they call it. When astronauts go to space and they look back at Earth, they don't see boundaries and countries. All they see is how beautiful Earth is and the fine layer of our atmosphere. So I heard Neil deGrasse Tyson explain it once by saying, if our Earth was an apple, our atmosphere is like the skin of the apple. That's how fragile our planet is. And for those who may know, Mars had a very similar atmosphere to Earth, and we believe life may have existed on Mars, but it had two incidences. And I learned this from a great show called How the Universe Works. It's amazing. So one was Mars was hit by another body that ripped its atmosphere off. And then the second thing that's happening to Mars is similar to Earth, is it rotates, and the Earth has a iron core, and that allows it to spin. Well, Mars is slowing down. And as it slows down, it's no longer creating an atmosphere and things that protect it from the solar winds of the sun. And so the solar winds of the sun are now ripping off and continuing to rip off the atmosphere. So when you think about how our planet was formed, it is very unique. And they are seeing other planets, but they're far, far away. You know, they're looking at exoplanets all over in other solar systems, but we can't get to them if something happened. So this is it. This is our ship. The planet Earth is our main ship. Now, we may go on and have stations and research stations on the moon or even on Mars, but I assure you, planet Earth is the best place you want to be. And some individuals like Jeff Bezos really wants to take the things that are harmful to our planet, like manufacturing and the pollutant things, and he wants to move manufacturing into outer space so that we're no longer harming our planet, that we make this where we are able to live and safeguard our future on this planet. So there's two different ways of looking at it. And then some people say, why would we not want to colonize other planets? I mean, we are, humanity is a species that continues to pursue, that continues to seek out new things. And so that can continue. And we may not do it initially. We're not sending humans yet. We're sending robots. So robots will go first. And then we talked about AI earlier. So imagine sending those robots out with AI and virtual reality. You could now have people here on Earth experience living on Mars or the moon. So there's a lot of ways that we're going to get from where we are today to where we may be living on Mars. But comparing Mars to the Earth is like comparing night and day. The best place, I think, is Earth. And I want to stay here on Earth. And I wish Elon Musk excellent opportunities as he goes on to, I know he wants to go to Mars. So,
all right. Thank you for kind of delving into my like playful kind of question.
What are you excited for over the next like 10, 20 years here on Earth?
Well, what I'm most excited about is how space can create access and opportunity for everyone here on Earth. You know, I talked about the 60s when we were doing the Apollo era, it was primarily just two countries, STEM professionals, white males, government workers. And now we see how we can bring diversity, underrepresented groups, emerging countries into the space equation. And these new countries that are coming into the space industry don't have to be like the US, right? They don't have to create huge launch vehicles. They don't have to have launch facilities. What they could do is they could create technology like communications technologies, tracking technology to help solve the challenges for their constituents. So one example I like to highlight is how we can use satellite technology to help track human and animal, illegal trafficking. You can see in Africa, there's a lot of challenge with illegal trafficking of, elephants, tusks, and ivory and everything. And you could use space technology to help track that and monitor that using that satellites and the AI tracking all the data. And you could use that. There's also, human trafficking. They've used space technology satellites to help traffic where they found human trafficking of individuals working on these fishing vessels. And they were able to build a case and then, rescue those fishermen who had been captured to do human trafficking. So there's a lot of things that space technologies is going to help us solve. And I'm really excited to see how it continues to solve challenges and how we're going to create more access and opportunity for everyone to be part of the space industry in their own unique way.
Are there any current technologies or potential future technologies that you're particularly excited about?
Well, I'm really excited about space and healthcare. So I'm working on a chapter in a book. The book is going to be on digital healthcare. So it's a normal health book, but I'm working with my great friend, Dr. Vanessa Farsadaki, who is a space medicine expert, and we're writing a chapter about space and healthcare. And we're talking about how space is helping to benefit our lives every day. You know, one of the great things that we haven't covered yet, I know we've covered a lot of stuff, is about the Hubble Space Telescope. You know, the Hubble Space Telescope was designed to look into space for anomalies, and a company commercialized that technology to now look into the human body for anomalies, and that's how we came up with mammogram detection. And there's a lot of companies, healthcare companies, that are doing things on the International Space Station because of the microgravity environment to look at how cancer forms, so we can figure out how can we unlock and maybe solve some of the cancers we have. There are companies who are looking at solving some of the challenges with osteoporosis, which is one of the challenges that women have as we age. You know, the bones brittle. Men get it too, but women get it more. And a great space agency that's doing a lot of work is DLR, which is the German Space Agency. If you look them up, I was just talking to one of their great space leaders, and he was telling me about some of the great experiments they have done, where they've sent human female torsos into space, one with a radiation protection, one without the radiation protection, to see how space can interfere with the human anatomy and create, you know, cancer. I mean, because right now our Earth's atmosphere is protecting us from those solar winds and the gamma rays and the things that come from space. But once astronauts leave Earth's atmosphere, they're exposed to that. We also are a species that's very used to living in a gravity environment. And so for men that go to space, they have a lot of challenges with their eyes, with the fluids can pool and cause their eyes to, you know, not be able to see well. And even when they return to Earth, it can be a challenge. So we see with women astronauts faster onset of osteoporosis, and we see with men ocular problems. And these are some of the things the German Space Agency is working on. So I think what's so exciting right now is the opportunities as we look at utilizing space and microgravity environment to really help us solve many of the health challenges that we have here on Earth. Another amazing woman who's leading Lambda Vision is looking at creating a lens replacement for macular degeneration. And right now, that is a disease that many older people suffer from, where they lose their sight. And right now, there is no solution. And so this amazing woman, Nicole Wagner, is creating a lens replacement. She's working with NASA and the International Space Station. She's going through all the technical trials to eventually we can hopefully solve macular degeneration. So these are just some of the amazing technologies that are currently being used, like mammogram detection, and some of the ones that hopefully will come to fruition in the next 5 to 10 years that will help us and help citizens right here on Earth live healthier lives.
That is so cool. And actually, while you were talking about that, I was just thinking of, if I'm remembering correctly, LASIK surgery also ended up being one of NASA's spin-off technologies, and that's one that I can think of that was healthcare related. But actually, you know, kind of just to shift topic, my last question was actually about your upcoming projects and with your books. Now, I also do have to hop off a little early. Sorry to our viewers, but this is what college looks like. But I did see your post last week talking about the article from Kevries, The Future is Collaborative, 15 Women Leading Global Innovation. And you talked about your upcoming book trilogy. And so I just kind of wanted to see, you know, what insight you could give us about those books, because I do think that's also at the forefront of space education. What can you tell us about that?
Excellent. Well, what I learned is over the last 5 years, I do about 100 speeches a year. And I've always had young people like yourself say, "Do you have a book? Do you have this written down somewhere?" And I was never able to work on it when I was working for someone else. So now that I'm working for myself, again, my goal is to be that motivational speaker and to write those books. I have a lot of great articles out in Space News, as well as Forbes and elsewhere. But my goal is to create a trilogy of books. And the first one I'm working on is Lessons Learned over my 25-year career in the space industry. The second one is going to be An Interstellar Guide to Success, how you can accomplish your goals and objectives. And then the third book is something I've learned during my space career that we need to create new forms of leaders and leadership. And I call them global transformational leaders, or GTL. And so that third book will be on being a GTL, which includes being inspirational, authentic, and having gratitude. So those books I'm working on right now, and I'm looking forward to talking more about those and those lessons learned I've had with you in future episodes, as well as with others around the globe.
Okay. So we just kind of have some like closing interview questions left, about like your advice to other individuals and stuff like that. So the first question is, what advice could you give to individuals interested in the space industry?
Well, I think one of the great things you can do is find a mentor and join organizations with like-minded people. So depending what your age demographic is, we'll say for the college students who might be listening today, a great organization to join is Space Generation Advisory Council. They are a global organization and they have a country chapter. So it's a great organization to find like-minded individuals, and they do great things. They also have a mentoring program. There are some other great organizations. I talked about ANUSA already, the United Nations Office of Outer Space Affairs. They have some great programs, Space for Women, Space for Youth, Space and Lawyers. So there's probably something that you can find with ANUSA that is something you're passionate about. And again, finding those like-minded individuals. You can also find mentors through, again, I talked about Space Generation Advisory Council, but another great mentoring organization is Women Tech Network. And these are all free mentoring programs. And Women Tech Network is open to men and women to be proteges as well as mentors. So those are some of the things I would do. And then the internet is amazing. You can go online. You can learn all kinds of things. Start reading articles, join these organizations, and find mentors.
All right. And then our last question for you today is, where are the best places for people to connect with you and your work?
Excellent. Well, I'm a big advocate of LinkedIn. I think no matter where you are, even if a high school student, you should have a LinkedIn professional profile, because, you know, if you want to come into the space industry or you want to get scholarships or grants, you should be creating that professional profile both on LinkedIn, as well as you should always have a resume. So you can never be too young to start that resume and show leadership and opportunities. So I am on LinkedIn. I do have Facebook, Instagram, as well as Twitter or X. I also have a website. Shelley Brunswick is my website, and I'm currently updating that right now. So I think that's how websites are. They're always in update mode. So those are great ways you can reach out. I do try to answer my LinkedIn accounts every week or so. So if you reach out, that's a great place. And I do have a YouTube channel.
And I'll make sure to link those things below in this video whenever it's on YouTube or Spotify.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right. I just want to say thank you for having an amazing conversation about the space industry. I know that it's very stressful for people wanting to get into the space industry, or like they don't know where to start. So I'm hoping that this conversation has illuminated a lot of those like fears and those kind of scaries about the space industry. But once again, thank you for joining us today. And it was a pleasure to have you.
The pleasure was all mine, and I look forward to seeing you around the galaxy.
And that's the tea. All right. Thank you so much.
I got my chai right here.